Let's cultivate our motivation. Let's reflect how fortunate we are to have encountered the Buddha's teachings. Many people don't have the opportunity even to encounter the Dharma. Some people encounter it but have no interest or no faith. Some people have encountered it, have interest and faith, but have a multitude of other hindrances and obstacles in their lives. So it's actually quite difficult to have the opportunity to hear, reflect on, and meditate on the Dharma. And since the Dharma is so precious because it leads us to liberation and enlightenment, we need to relish this opportunity while we have it. Without wasting it, without taking it for granted. One of the best ways to use this opportunity is to generate the bodhicitta, the aspiration to benefit sentient beings by attaining full enlightenment. And so let's generate that as our long-term aspiration. And together with that, let's generate a mind of a lot of patience and fortitude that can bear the difficulties of practicing the path and can bear them happily because we know that it brings a good result. Just contemplate that motivation and generate it now. So, we were on the first point in the book, or if you have this version of the book on page 19, the third paragraph. Actually, the first has been talking about the meditation session, and so at the beginning of the meditation session, performing the six preparatory practices, such as cleaning the room, establishing the altar, and so on. And then, secondly, is the actual meditation session. Okay? Remember the six preparatory practices? First one? Cleaning the room. Okay. And preparing the altar. Second? Not yet. Not yet. What do you do? What do you do every morning? Come on. No. Make offerings. My goodness. You didn't even review your notes from last week before we start? Well, if it weren't for the people online, I would stop right now and have you review. But you're saved by the people online. So next time, third preparatory practice.
Get yourself seated correctly.
And do what else?
Breathing meditation.
Yeah, calm your mind down. Okay, fourth. Okay, take refuge and generate your motivation. Fifth?
Seven limb prayer.
Six? Requesting the lineage. remember, with the prayer of the three purposes. Okay, if you don't remember this, how some of you have been around for many years. How can you not remember this? What are you practicing?
We're doing it. We're not reciting the sequence. I apologize.
Okay, I mean, if you're doing it, then you should be able to know what it is. Yeah? Yeah? And if you're not doing it, then you should be doing it. Yeah, because otherwise I'm wasting my time. Yeah, because why should I teach if nobody does anything with it? Okay, so next it's talking about the meditation session itself. That was talking about the preparatory practices. Now we have the actual meditation session. So here I'll read, and what he's talking about here is, again, like really generating the motivation and the correct worldview and the correct idea of what we're doing. So he says, secondly, during the actual meditation session, we should reflect that throughout beginningless time, we have been under the power of the mind, and the mind in turn has been overcome by disturbing emotions or afflictions. These afflictions are what have given rise to the actions. And here it says the actions that are the root of cyclic existence, but I think there's a mistranslation here, because the root of cyclic existence is ignorance. Okay, and ignorance gives rise to the afflictions, which give rise to the karma, which are the origin of cyclic existence, but not the root. Okay, from these actions have arisen the various types of sufferings that we experience in the round of existence. So those are the situations in which we live right now. We're not talking theoretical abstractions. What our life is right now, and all the things that happened today that we didn't like, and even all the happiness we have today that we did like, all of that is unsatisfactory. Yeah, and so all of that is what we're experiencing in some cyclic existence. So don't think that cyclic existence is something else that other people experience, or it's something that I only experience when I think about it, or it's something that I only experience when I'm miserable, but our life from moment to moment, you know, answering the telephone, driving in the car. Yeah, this whole thing is involved with cyclic existence. Yeah, not studying your notes, forgetting the answers to the questions. That's all involved in cyclic existence. Okay, to turn away from such tendencies, we must try to develop an independent, controlled, and workable mind. I think the word independent is a bit strange there. Again, I don't have the Tibetan to be able to check it. But the mind is never independent, so I'm not quite sure what it means. When it talks about a controlled and workable mind, it means a mind that's serviceable, a mind that's open and receptive, that's, that has pliancy, meditative pliancy, so it can remain on the object. Okay, a controlled and workable mind that will stay where it is put or go where it is sent. So we want to be able to send our mind, quote, send our mind to the object of meditation and also keep it put there. Yeah. To acquire such a state of mind, it is necessary to focus on the specific subject of meditation without being distracted by either laxity or excitement. So laxity is a subtle thinking, a spaced outedness in your meditation, and excitement is distraction to an object of attachment. These meditations, so it's talking here about the meditations of the stages of the path of the Lamrim. These meditations should follow the given order, and except for training in the perfection of concentration, are all analytical meditations. So if we look at all of the meditations in the Lamrim, we should do them in the order that they're presented, because that order has a whole psychology behind it. You know, the meditations are divided into, the initial level of practitioner, the medium, and the highest level of practitioner. And with each of the three levels, there's the meditations that you do to cultivate a certain motivation. There's the motivation, you know, or the practice itself, the motivation itself, the attitude that you're trying to develop. And then there's what you do as a result of that. Yeah. So if you do these meditations in order, then you'll have all of that. You'll be developing it in a proper sequence. Okay? And so for all these meditations on the Lam Rim, they're all the analytic meditation except for far-reaching concentration, and that is stabilizing meditation. Okay? By saying they're all analytic meditation, remember that when you do the meditation at the end, then you can practice some stabilizing meditation in keeping your mind on the experience, the feeling that was generated. And then third, in conclusion, we should make perfect prayers, such as the prayer of good conduct and so forth. The prayer of good conduct, that's the extraordinary aspiration of the Bodhisattva Samantabhadra. Okay, Samantabhadra, if you translate his name, it can mean good conduct. Okay, so the king of prayers. And that's how you dedicate. And we should practice in this way three times during the day and three times during the night. So what this means is that, the ideal situation is to practice the Lam Rim meditation six times a day. Yeah? Now, you may not be able to do that in your regular life. So then at least do, however many sessions you can. Okay, so when it talks about six sessions, it means one before dawn, two between breakfast and midday, two in the afternoon, and then one in the evening. Okay, during meditation sessions, the senses should be controlled. Okay, so that means that your senses, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind, they should be controlled. In other words, your senses shouldn't be running all over the place. When you're meditating, you shouldn't be looking around the room. What's everybody else doing? How many of you look around the room and see what everybody else is doing? A little bit. Every once in a while. Okay. Okay, our ears shouldn't be active. We shouldn't be listening to things. So that means we shouldn't be focusing on whether somebody's breathing loud or clicking their mala or whether the heater's going on and off. Okay, smelling. You shouldn't be, imagining smells or focusing on the smells. Who didn't take a shower, Taste. You shouldn't be imagining what's happening for breakfast. What's going to be served, or thinking of what you're going to cook if it's your day to cook. Okay. And then the mind also should be controlled. So the mind shouldn't be wandering all over, making lots of plans. Yeah. All these kinds of things. What am I going to do? Who am I working with today? Okay. So we should have a controlled mind. And then we should practice mindfulness here it says during meditation sessions. I think it means between meditation sessions. Okay? I mean, also the senses should be controlled during meditation sessions. But this instruction for the senses to be controlled, to practice mindfulness and introspection and a balanced diet. You aren't going to practice a balanced diet during your meditation session. I think maybe this should be between meditation sessions. Okay, so your senses should be controlled, not planning your shopping lists and things like that. Practice mindfulness and introspective awareness, or that checking mind that sees what's going on in your mind. Okay, so in between meditation sessions, you should know what you're doing, why you're doing it. If you're going somewhere, be aware that you're going, why you're going, how you're going. Okay, you don't just get in the car and go somewhere and then figure out where it is later on. Okay? I mean, many people in the city do that, don't they? Yeah, I'm bored. Let's get in the car. Okay. If you're walking, you should be walking mindfully and aware of what you're doing and why you're doing something. Okay, not just kind of here and there and talking all sorts of nonsense and chattering with our friends and things like that. Okay, because if we do that during the break sessions, the break times, then when we get back in meditation, we're reviewing all the conversations we had, and what everybody said and what I should have said, and then we're worrying about whether they got the right idea of what we said, or maybe they don't think so well of us because we didn't express ourselves well. So then we start planning the next conversation so that we can correct the mistakes of the previous conversation. Because we want everybody to like us, don't we? We don't want anybody to think badly of us. So we plan all of this in our meditation session. Right? And review it. Yeah. Oh, I'm on lunch today. What should I make? Yeah. Okay, so, we go off. In between sessions, we should maintain a balanced diet. So not eating too little and not eating too much. If we eat too little, then our body is unhealthy and it's weak, and that influences our meditation. We won't be able to concentrate very well. If we eat too much, the body is heavy, and we tend to fall asleep in our meditation. Yeah. Also, if you're eating a lot of sugar, you're likely to have sugar rushes and then the drop from the sugar rush afterwards. Okay, if you have a lot of caffeine, you have this subtle energy in your body. I remember when I lived in Italy, because I've never been a coffee drinker, but I decided when I lived in Italy, this is 1980, that I would try coffee. I remember I had one small cup. The whole night, I could feel this energy going through my body. Forget about sleeping. It was just like, like a generator motor going on, in your nervous system. Okay, not conducive for meditation. Okay, so it's good if we can be vegetarian. It's not necessary, but it actually is very much preferred. Because if you eat meat, then you also pick up the energy of the animals that you're eating too. Efforts should be made to become an unsleeping yogi. Well, I think the yogis actually sleep 4 hours in the middle of the night. What the Buddha recommended is you sleep 4 hours just right smack in the middle, like from 10 to 2, We do the opposite. We sleep from 2 to 10. It should be from 10 to 2. Okay. And you should know how to use the period of sleep to develop calm abiding and special insight as taught by the Exalted Asanga. Actually, the whole thing about sleep is a very important topic in terms of your meditation practice. If you sleep too little, it's going to affect your health. If you sleep too much, you're going to be sleepy in your meditation sessions. Okay? Lots of times people, when they get sleepy in their meditation sessions, they think that the antidote is to stop the meditation session and go to sleep. That's not always the antidote. If you slept maybe 3 hours the night before and your body and mind are really exhausted, well, then you are short on sleep. But just because you're sleeping in a meditation session does not mean that your body is not rested. Okay? Because lots of times this sleep comes as a karmic obstacle. Yeah? We sit down to meditate. The body and mind are not tired. Because if you had an opportunity at that very moment to spend some time with some friends, you would be wide awake. Yeah, you wouldn't be falling asleep. We'd be chattering with our friends, taking a walk, playing basketball. You know, we would wouldn't be falling asleep. So it's just a karmic obstacle that's coming in the form of sleep. And so if every time we get sleepy in our meditation session, we say, well, I better go to sleep, then we're never going to meditate. And what's going to happen instead is you're going to oversleep. And when you oversleep, then your mind is very dull, isn't it? You know, when you sleep too much, the mind is very dull. You can see it. Yeah? Okay? So, you know, sleeping too much, you know, and being very attached to sleep are caused to be reborn as an animal. So if you're sleeping a lot and you're sleeping unnecessarily, just think about, you know, well, okay, I'm creating the cause to be born as an animal where I'm going to sleep a lot, but do I really want to be born as an animal? Yeah? That cat sleeping there, that cat sleeping there. Okay, do you want to be reborn as a cat sleeping? Yeah? I mean, the cats, look at them. They're so fortunate. They're around so much Dharma, they can't take it in. You know, let alone the animals who are, you know, it breaks my heart. I see the donkeys in Dharamsala, you know, and they pack them on the back. You've seen that. With this incredible heavy gravel, and then they beat them to get them to walk up the hill. And you just look in the donkey's eyes, and they're just so blurred, you know. It's like, it's really miserable. And I think of being born like that, and it's like, ugh. You know, it's actually quite scary. Yeah? So if you have a lot of attachment to sleep, spend some time doing the meditation, imagining yourself born as an animal. Yeah? And just be aware, you know, if I'm sleeping when, you know, if you're sleeping because your body and mind are legitimately tired, it's one thing. But if you're attached to sleep and indulging in sleep, then just think, you know, I'm creating the cause to be born, you know, like some of these grasshoppers we see outside. And then, you know, think of your mind being like a grasshopper, and you know, because those beings are sentient beings just like us. They've been our mothers in previous lives. But, you know, you create some negative karma and then you get that kind of rebirth. Yeah? So if you really do a good meditation like that, then you'll stay awake. Yeah? It really wakes you up. Yeah? So some people, I remember my first Dharma course, somebody was saying, you know, oh, a lot of people, they just think sleeping is so relaxing and enjoyable, but you're not even awake to enjoy it. Are you? How enjoyable. While you're sleeping, are you enjoying sleeping? You can't enjoy sleeping while you're sleeping because you aren't awake to enjoy it. So what is so marvelous about sleeping? Yeah? Okay, if the body's tired, if the mind's tired, okay, one thing. But, you know, we really need to look carefully at this, because otherwise our whole precious human life just, you know, we could spend a third or more of our life sleeping. Okay? If you sleep 8 hours a day, that's a third of your life. Think of that. You know, it's a third of your life. So if you live to be 60, you've spent 20 years nonstop sleeping. Think about it. You know, I mean, our whole life can go by just sleeping, sleeping, sleeping. And then when we're not sleeping, we're dozing, you know, or we're trying to wake up, or we're, you know, preparing to go to bed. So I think that's quite important, you know, that you should carry an alarm clock with you. I mean, I never wait until my body wakes up naturally. If I did, you know, forget it. You'd hardly ever see me. Yeah? So I don't think your body waking up naturally is the definition of sufficient sleep. I can function on a lot less sleep than it takes for my body to wake up naturally. Yeah, because if I wake up naturally, then I'm usually like, very groggy afterwards. So, you know, take an alarm clock with you wherever you are and use it, especially if you're going to do meditation practice in the morning. Yeah, because if you wake up too late, then the activities of the day have already started. It's very difficult to meditate because the phone's ringing, the other people you live are running around doing something. Yeah, you're hungry. So it's really important to get up early when it's still quiet. You know, there's nothing else to do, and you just go to your cushion and sit. It's very nice that way. Yeah? So we should make a practice of doing that, whether we're at the Abbey or not at the Abbey, you know, to have a very, very consistent meditation practice like that. Yeah, some people, when they're at the Abbey, very consistent. Then the day they leave the Abbey or the Dharma environment, you know, acting completely different. That's not good, you know, because for our practice to succeed, we need to keep it steady and stable. If we do a whole lot one day and nothing the next day, if we get 4 hours of sleep one day and 12 the next day, you know, that's not a good internal, external environment for Dharma practice. Okay? So we should try and keep our body and mind balanced. Yeah? And do our meditation practice every day, you know, go to sleep about the same time every day, something like that. Keep some kind of balance and regularity in our lives. I wonder who fell asleep while I was talking about this. We have all sorts of interesting ways of not hearing the teachings, don't we? Okay, so if you're falling asleep in your meditation, then you should do prostrations before you sit down to meditate. Because if you do a set of full-length prostrations, you know, your body's moving, you're wide awake. Yeah, or put really cold water on your face and your head. Yeah, don't wear so many clothes, you're a little bit cold. Okay. So now we're going on to the first meditation in the Lamrim here, or not in the Lamrim, in the preliminary practices, which, remember the four preliminary practices that we're doing? The first point, remember, says first train in the preliminaries. What are the four preliminaries?
Huh? Yeah,
precious human life,
death
and impermanence,
karma
and its effects, the sufferings of cyclic existence. Okay? So we're starting on those four meditations now, explaining what they are. Okay. So it says, the nature of life as a free and fortunate human being is freedom from the eight states without leisure and possession of the 10 beneficial circumstances. The eight states with no leisure are given in the friendly letter. That's by Nagarjuna. Okay, so I'll read the verse and then go back and explain it. Being born as one holding wrong views, as an animal, a hungry ghost, or a hell being, in a place where the Buddha's word does not prevail, as a barbarian in remote regions, stupid and dumb, or as a long-living god, are the eight states without leisure. Having found the opportunity of freedom from them, exert yourself to turn away from birth. Okay. The eight states without leisure fall into two categories, four pertaining to humans and four to inhuman life. Okay. So, the first one here, being born as one holding wrong views. Okay. So, somebody who... it doesn't mean that you're born. It says born, but it means living as, okay? Somebody who holds wrong views, so somebody who doesn't believe in cause and effect. Yeah, somebody who thinks, you know, our ethical actions have no ramifications at all, that things just happen by chance, that kind of stuff, okay? Somebody born as an animal, yeah? So the cats, the grasshoppers, the chipmunks, your dogs, the squirrels, you know, all these other living beings that we share the space with. You know? So in meditating on these eight, you know, we have been born as all these things in previous lives. So we are free from that kind of birth this lifetime. But we're not free from that kind of birth forever. Because at any moment, this life stops. And then according to our karma, if we have the negative karma like that, we could be in one of these lives. Okay? So just for right now, we're free. But we don't know how for how long. Okay? Yeah. So, you know, if you look, think about being born with somebody with wrong views. You know, I'm sure you know lots of people with wrong views. Very stubborn, cynical, wrong views. And being born like that, and then if you live your whole life like that, and you might even, you know, be famous and write a few books, and people might honor and respect you in society, but what kind of karma are you going to create? And what kind of life are you going to have after this lifetime if you're a person who has wrong views? Okay? Or imagine being born as an animal. Yeah, just do that. Imagine being born with one of our kitties. Yeah. Yeah. Or one of the grasshoppers. I remember one time I was in Malaysia and they took me to a zoological park because they have all sorts of really interesting looking animals in Malaysia, and there was a bird, some kind of incredible bird, so colorful, with this huge long beak. You know, it was many different colors. And I looked at that, and that bird and I looked at each other in the eye, you know, for the longest time. And I had the real sense, like, wow, you know, it was like there was a human being, but trapped in that kind of body, and so unable to communicate or, you know, really think clearly. But it was such a feeling of like, wow, that's like a human being, but totally trapped in that kind of body, you know, for a whole life. Yeah, big beak and eating food and everybody comes, you know, you're famous. Everybody, you know what this is probably a result of? Being attached to being beautiful and being noticed. Yeah? When you're really attached to, am I beautiful? Do people look at me? Yeah? So you have that kind of attachment, and then you have some negative karma for a lower rebirth? Yeah? You know, we wind up as some kind of animal that everybody wants to look at. And you're sitting there, you know, like that all day. Can't think. Huh? Do you ever do that when you walk down the road, look at the cows or look at the horses? Stop, you know, by the fence and really look in the eyes of those cows. Look in the eyes of those horses, you know, and think, what is it like being in that body? Because you can't think in the same way. You know, cows and horses think, but not in the same way that human beings do. Hmm? Do you want to be whipped? Do you want to be branded? Do you want to be fed only so they can stuff you in a cattle car and then, you know, cut your throat and eat your body? You know, so think about what it's like being born as an animal. It's actually fairly scary. Yeah. Or, you know, when I stayed at your house, Kathleen, there were the fish in the bedroom I stayed in. I used to look at those fish, you know, the goldfish, tropical fish. Oh, I thought, my goodness, what kind of life is that? You know, your whole environment is like this big, and you just swim back and forth. And even if you had a bigger environment, it would be more dangerous for that kind of fish because they'd get eaten up sooner, you know. But what do they think about all day? What does a fish think about? What do you do? All you do is swim back and forth and you breathe and hope to get some food. And that's it. You know, the whole day, total, spaced out like that. To me, that's like really scary. Yeah? So spend some time thinking like that. And then think, oh, but I'm not born like that right now. How fortunate I am. You know, I'm a human being and I've met the Dharma and I can practice. Unbelievable. Yeah. Okay, or being born as a hungry ghost. Yeah. So hungry ghosts, we might have a harder time because, you know, they describe them with big bellies and narrow necks and, you know, they're running around trying to get food and, you know, can't get it. So, you know, think about that. I mean, if you can't identify so much with the body description, that's okay. But try even thinking about the body description. I mean, we don't know what kind of beings there are that we haven't seen, do we? Yeah. So try thinking like that, you know. You have a huge extended belly, a tiny throat, you're starving. You see some food, you run towards it, and as soon as you get there, it's pus and blood. Or you manage to get there, get a little bit in your mouth, and you can't swallow it because your nose, your throat's too small. You know? Some people in the hospital, some human beings even have this difficulty, you know, but this is far worse as a hungry ghost. Or you swallow it and then your whole stomach is on fire. You know? So think about that in a literal way in terms of food. But you know what I also think about hungry ghost as? Because to me, hungry ghost mentality, I was mentioning it this morning, is like this very needy mind. You know, the mind that I want, I need. The mind of like such incredible attachment that I got to have it. I can't imagine going without this, you know. And then think you rush to whatever it is that you think you really have to have and you're on the verge of getting it. And then it falls apart before your eyes. So it's like, you know how some people are in romantic relationships? They want so much. I just want somebody to love me. I just want somebody to love me. As soon as they rush and find a relationship, what happens? You know, the person goes away. And so that's that same idea of frustration that a hungry ghost has, you know? Or you so much want to be famous, or you so much want a certain status in your job, you're incredibly attached, you know? And then it's almost within your reach, and it's gone, you know? So that's kind of that, like that mind. It could be like an Olympic athlete who so much craves to have a gold medal, you know? And they're almost there, and then they can't get it, or they get it, and then the judges change their mind and you know, invalidate their participation in the competition. Yeah? So that kind of frustration and pain, you know? Or as a hell being, yeah? Where your whole world is just intense physical suffering. Yeah? So ask yourself, you know, if I'm born as an animal, how am I going to practice the Dharma? If I'm born as a hungry ghost, how am I going to practice the Dharma? If I'm born as a hell being, how am I going to practice the Dharma? So our mind always says, oh, well, I'm a hell being. I have faith in the Dharma. I'll manage. I'll do taking and giving meditation as a hell being. We got to put our feet on the ground. What happens? We have a little mild stomach ache. Can we even sit in the meditation hall with a little teeny weeny stomach ache? No, we're out of there like this. Oh, I gotta go to bed. You know? Some tiny, tiny thing hurts and we can't meditate at all. Yeah? It's true, isn't it? I can't even sit in the meditation hall. You know, I'm so hungry, I can't sit in the meditation hall. I have to go eat something. Yeah? And we think we're going to be able to practice as a hungry ghost. Yeah, right. You know? I mean, we're such wimps. If we're with a friend doing something fun, doesn't matter if we have a stomachache, doesn't matter if we're hungry, does it? But we're in the meditation hall, little bit of hunger, little bit of sleepiness, little bit of a bad mood, you know. Oh, I can't practice. I've got to leave. Or we walk out of the meditation hall, you know, it doesn't matter if we disturb everybody else's meditation. No. I can't stay in here. Yeah. They said to take good care of myself. I'm doing that. We are wimps galore, aren't we? We're so wimpy. Okay, so being born in a place where the Buddha's word does not prevail, so that's in a place where the Buddha has not taught the Dharma, you know, where there's no Buddhist teachings at all. As a barbarian in a remote region, so in a very kind of, in a place where people don't have any idea of ethical conduct, okay, we're not talking about, you know, primitive societies, yeah, because very often primitive societies have a much better idea of ethical conduct than civilized societies do, or what we call civilized societies. Okay, but in a place where, you know, there's no kind of respect for ethical conduct, being born stupid and dumb, okay, so your senses don't function properly, you can't read the Dharma, you can't hear the Dharma, you can't think properly, yeah. So you might actually be born in a very rich country and have this kind of hindrance. I went to Denmark once. I was invited there to teach, and one of the women at the center, she worked in a home for disabled children, and so she took me there. I asked to go, you know, and I remember walking in this room, and Denmark's a very wealthy country, and it was this colorful room with so many toys and balloons and balls and educational equipment. And at first, I remember the first thing I saw was all these beautiful colors just everywhere, you know? And at first, I didn't see any people, yeah? And then I started to hear these funny sounds, and I started looking closer, and there were these kids who were really severely disabled, you know? And just some of them, you know, as 15 years old, but lying in cribs or lying over, they would have these things that had like four wheels so they could move the kids easily, and they were just kind of lying over that. Or just sitting, you know, in all sorts of weird positions. And the kids, like, were so severely handicapped. I mean, some of them couldn't see, some of them couldn't hear. None of them could think very well. Yeah. But incredible wealth. Incredible wealth. Yeah. And so here you see, you know, I mean, what kind of karma is that? They're born as human beings. So, you know, result of some of ethical conduct. They live in a wealthy place as a result of generosity. But their minds are incapacitated, and very often their bodies were incapacitated too. Yeah? Because of some very strong hindering karma. Maybe a karma from wrong views or, you know, something like that. Yeah? So very scary to think of being born like that, yeah? Because you're using up all your good karma of ethical conduct and generosity. It's all getting used, you know, it's getting used up, but nothing good is coming out of it because you can't use your mind properly, you know? Same thing with somebody who has wrong views. They're using up a lot of good karma and just creating horrible karma in the process of it. Okay, as a long living God, yeah. So there's a certain realm where the beings have neither perception nor non-perception. They're in a kind of concentration where they are so spaced out, yeah, that it's almost difficult to tell whether there's even perception or consciousness at all. Okay? So these are states without leisure. Here, leisure means the leisure to practice the Dharma, the freedom to practice the Dharma. Because if you're born in any of these situations, it's impossible. You know, impossible. Okay? When we think like this, then, yeah, if we're in the meditation hall and we're a little tired or a little hungry or a little bit in a bad mood or whatever, if we remember what these hindrances are, and then we think, I have this itty-bitty tiny thing, but wow, I actually am free from the eight big, you know, these eight big non-leisure states. I better take advantage of my opportunity to practice right now. Because if I don't take care of it, if I don't take this advantage of the present opportunity, when am I going to have a better one? Because tomorrow, my mind's going to make the same excuses, isn't it? Yeah? So if I don't take advantage now, well, then when am I? And at the time I get to death, what am I going to show for it? Yeah? So then the mind says, well, I listened to Dharma teachings. I'll have that to show for it. Well, that's good. We created some good karma listening to Dharma teachings. But we could have created a lot more good karma if we had actually put them into practice. But instead, you know, we're so attached to the happiness of this life that we, you know, we go for our creature comfort and waste so much time. And you know what I've also been thinking about too? You know what is a huge waste of time? Getting angry. Yeah? It's such an enormous waste of time. I don't know about you, but I can spend when I get angry, I can spend a long time reciting the story that they did and da 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 da. It is such a waste of time. Here we have a precious human life with the opportunity to generate bodhicitta, to realize emptiness, and we're spending our time reliving all the horrible things people said and did to us. What a waste of time. Isn't it? You know? So when we really believe it's a waste of time, then we just stop it. You know? Similarly, another big waste of time is daydreaming and the mind of attachment. Oh, I want this pleasure, and I want to get this, and I want to eat that, and I want to be with this kind of person. And then I'm going to meet this person. Then we're going to go here. We're going to do this. And da, 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 planning our future. Such a waste of time, isn't it? You know? Daydreaming in la-la land. Yeah. Sometimes we even daydream about all the future retreats we're going to do. You know, we're in retreat right now. But instead of focusing on the object of meditation, we think, oh, I really like retreat. After this retreat, I want to do that retreat, and then I'm going to do that retreat, and then I'm going to do this one, then I'm going to do that one. And we spend a whole meditation session planning out our Dharma practice, but we actually never do any Dharma practice. Right? I got an email from a friend of mine who was doing retreat, who wrote me all about health insurance for one of our teachers, which was clearly one of his objects of meditation during the retreat. Yeah, how to come up with perfect health insurance for one of our teachers. Yeah, no, sure, it's true, you know, having health insurance for one of our teachers is that, you know, that's a very virtuous thing to try and arrange. Okay. But not in the middle of your meditation session in retreat when you're supposed to be focusing on something else. Yeah? So we'll do this, won't we? You know, we'll plan our other retreats. We'll do this. You know, we'll design Chenrezi Hall. You know, right now we're building this building. So then the next one, we'll design the next building. This winter, you know, in our winter retreat, we'll design Chenrezi Hall. that at the end of the retreat we'll conglomerate all of our ideas and take them to the architect. You know, we can, you know, our mind is so creative about how to distract ourselves, isn't it? And it is all such a waste of time. And you know what else is a big waste of time? Is the mind that's thinking, if I only had this situation, then I could really practice Dharma well. Yeah? So if I were only at this place, then I could practice Dharma well. If I could only study that text, then I could practice Dharma well. If I only had this initiation, then I could do some serious practice. If I only didn't have a cramp in my knee, then I could really develop single-pointedness. You know, if only my tooth didn't hurt, then my meditation would be wonderful. You know, if only the room were a little bit warmer, or the room were a little bit cooler, then my meditation would be very nice. And we could spend so much time on if-onlys, can't we? You know, why can't I practice Dharma? Because this one tiny thing, you know. Like I said, we're wimps, aren't we? Yeah? And so we do the if-only meditation. Yeah? And it's such a waste of time. Glorious waste of time. Okay. Why? Because the only time to practice Dharma is now, not when we get another situation or move to another place or hear a certain teaching or this and that. The only time we have to practice is now. And the situation we're in right now is the situation we practice in right now, not our dream situation in the future. We practice now with what's happening now. And transforming our mind right now is what Dharma practices. Okay, so you're in a bad mood, you don't feel like meditating, you sit on the cushion and you meditate anyway and you transform your mind. Yeah? You say, I'm too tired, I can't meditate, you sit on the cushion anyway. You know? You do some prostrations, put some cold water in your face, you sit down. You do some practice. Because when else are you going to practice? When are you going to be totally wide awake and able to practice? After you have some coffee. If only I had some coffee, then my meditation would be good. If only the Abbey would let me have some coffee. Why don't they let me drink coffee at the Abbey? You know, tea is okay. Why do they drink tea and they won't let me drink coffee? And you spend a whole meditation session on that. It's not fair. They're hypocrites, you know. And the whole life goes by, doesn't it? Yeah? We waste so much time. Okay, so the eight states without leisure fall into two categories. Four pertaining to humans. Okay, you got them, and four to not inhuman states. Okay, we have a few minutes left if you have some questions. Yeah?
I don't understand, like, how the fish, let's take the fish and the fishbowl, how many would ever create merit and move organisms?
Yeah. Okay, so how would a fish in the fishbowl create merit? Extremely difficult. So how does somebody get out of the lower realms after you're born there? With great difficulty, because it depends. Once you're born in the lower realms, it's usually a karma that you created as a human being in a previous life that has to ripen at the end of your animal rebirth life. Okay. Sometimes animals can create some good karma. There is some possibility, but it's very difficult. So it's usually some good karma that you created before as a human being. But then to get it to ripen at the end of your animal life, you have to have a positive thought, or you have to hear mantra, or something has to spark that. How many animals have the opportunity to die in that kind of situation? Very difficult, isn't it? Yeah? And you look, and you know, how many animals are there on this planet compared to the number of human beings? And then you can see how, you know, having even a human life, not even a precious human life, but just a human life is very rare compared to an animal rebirth. Yeah, let alone a precious human life.
Thinking along those lines, you know, when Eli was young, I took him and he did so much work in the hospital. And
yeah.
So that would help him in his next life.
Okay, so you have a dog that is a hospital dog, yeah, that goes, and so would that help him in his next life? I would imagine to some extent that would, but it might be hard for him to have generated a really positive motivation, but still he had an attitude of friendliness and kindness often towards the patients that he visited, so that's good. But it's good that when he does pass away that you say lots of mantra and that you, you know, read the various, you know, the three principal aspects to him, foundation of all good qualities, and don't even wait until he dies to do this, you know. Pet owners should definitely read out Dharma things out loud so their pets can hear. Okay, so this week spend some time meditating on these eight. Okay? And really imagine in your meditation, imagine having that life. Really get into it. And then come out of it and say, oh, but I'm not born like that right now. I have a precious human life with the opportunity to learn, reflect, and meditate on the Dharma. Unbelievable. Okay? So when you're meditating, really go into that state, and then at the end, kind of think, oh, but actually I'm not like that now. I'm so fortunate. I've got to make use of this life. Okay? And then you might ask yourself, well, how do I make use of this life? Well, by transforming your mind. Yeah? By observing karma and its effects. By generating wisdom, by meditating on love and compassion and bodhicitta, by practicing generosity, by practicing ethical conduct, by practicing fortitude and joyous effort and concentration and wisdom, all these things, that's how you make your life meaningful. Okay? So make this meditation very practical so you come out of it with a very strong determination. Yeah? To make your life meaningful, and you know exactly what you need to do to make your life meaningful, and you're determined to do it, and you're not going to waste your time on stupidagios. Okay? So, you know, this meditation can be very helpful for clarifying our mind like this.